Imagine a world where corporations don't just sell products, but lifestyles, where logos aren't just stamps of ownership, but badges of identity, and where marketing isn't just about convincing you to buy things, but about colonizing your mental space. This isn't science fiction. It's the world Naomi Klein exposed in No Logo. When the book appeared in 1999, it struck such a profound cultural nerve that it became the unofficial handbook for the anti-globalization movement. What made Klein's analysis revolutionary wasn't just its critique of corporate power, but how it connected the glossy logos we wear to the hidden exploitation they often represent. The late 1980s marked a fundamental shift when companies like Nike and Microsoft discovered they could thrive not by manufacturing products, but by creating powerful brand identities. After Philip Morris purchased Kraft for 6 times its paper value, corporations realized logos themselves could be worth more than physical assets, sparking what Klein calls a race toward weightlessness. Owning the least, employing the fewest, while producing the most powerful brand images. Corporate identity underwent radical transformation. Nike redefined itself as a sports company that enhances people's lives through sports and fitness, rather than just a shoe manufacturer. Polaroid became a social lubricant instead of a camera company. The Body Shop sold political philosophy about women and environment more than cosmetics. Even industrial giants like Caterpillar and Intel embraced branding, with Intel selling mascot-themed bean dolls. Tommy Hilfiger exemplified this trend by operating entirely through licensing while manufacturing nothing. Logos evolved from hidden placement to becoming the central feature of apparel. Once discreet emblems grew into chest-sized marquees, with Hilfiger turning wearers into walking, talking, life-size Tommyvilles. As Klein notes, the metaphorical alligator has risen up and swallowed the literal shirt. This obsession expanded beyond products to branding the outside culture through sponsorships, with the ultimate goal becoming to be the culture itself. As brands expanded beyond products, they aggressively colonized public spaces. Toronto's Queen Street was painted silver for Levi's Silver Tab campaign. Los Angeles created Genesis LA, letting corporations adopt run-down inner-city areas. In Kashmir, Washington, a candy factory threatened to leave unless the town became a tourist attraction for their brand. Media transformed into branded territory, with MTV's model, where the medium becomes the brand, spreading to most major outlets. Films embraced product placement, while musicians used companies like Gap as promotional platforms. Sports emerged as perhaps the most aggressively branded cultural space, with Nike turning select athletes into superstars embodying athletic transcendence. Even humans became branded spaces. Michael Jordan built his super brand through synergy deals and by starring in Space Jam, which incorporated all his endorsed products. When Jordan retired from basketball, he expanded his Jordan clothing line to compete with major fashion brands. A new paradigm emerged, where fashion designers, shoe companies, media outlets, cartoon characters, and celebrities all shared the same essential business, brand marketing. Corporate America's marketing focus shifted dramatically after Marlboro Friday in 1993. When Philip Morris slashed cigarette prices to compete with bargain brands, companies discovered that while adults sought deals, teens remained willing to pay premium prices to fit in. This created opportunities for change agents, young workers who could deliver authentic youth culture to corporations. Tommy Hilfiger perfected the science of harnessing ghetto cool for mass marketing. Initially white preppy wear, Hilfiger noticed his clothes gaining cachet in inner cities, where the hip-hop philosophy of living large made expensive gear a status symbol. He strategically repositioned his brand by shooting ads in yacht clubs while redesigning clothes with bolder colors and more prominent logos, simultaneously selling white youth on their fetishization of black style and black youth on their fetishization of white wealth. Schools in the 1990s faced a financial crisis, lacking funds for textbooks while being expected to provide technology. As governments prioritized computer funding over music and physical education, corporations seized sponsorship opportunities. Companies wanted their brands integrated into curriculum, not just logo placement. Channel One exemplified this by broadcasting mandatory ads to 8 million students across 12,000 schools, charging premium rates for this captive audience. Corporate influence expanded to textbook covers with ads, branded cafeteria menus, and fast food outlets within schools. At Greenbrier High School's Coke Day, students formed a human Coca-Cola logo. When senior Mike Cameron wore a Pepsi shirt, he was suspended for defiance against visiting Coca-Cola executives. In universities, corporations controlled research outcomes. When Dr. Betty Dong discovered a brand-named thyroid drug was equivalent to its generic version, saving patients $365 million annually, the manufacturer blocked publication using a contract clause, giving them veto power over results. Unlike public debates over prayer or sex education, education's commercialization occurred through thousands of small, barely noticed decisions. Many parents and educators rationalized inaction, believing students were already so immersed in advertising that protecting educational spaces seemed futile. By August 1992, during the brand crisis of Marlboro Friday, corporations began viewing identity politics as an opportunity rather than a threat. Over the next 5 years, cause-related merchandise proliferated as researchers identified diversity as the defining idea for Gen Xers, making it the perfect branding theme. As corporations expanded globally, they needed to sell identical products across borders. Diversity marketing provided the solution. Companies could market diversity itself to all markets simultaneously. This mono-multiculturalism replaced the Marlboro Man with Ricky Martin, creating a one-world placelessness that could sell globally without triggering accusations of Coca-Colonization. The global teen demographic, 1 billion strong, became marketers' prime target due to their outsized consumption of family income. In China, Little Emperor Syndrome meant families sacrificed for one child to emulate Western consumer culture. Meanwhile, campus identity politics of the 1990s focused primarily on representation and language while ignoring deeper economic issues like poverty and wealth distribution. Klein argues these diversity victories ultimately amounted to rearranging the furniture while the house burned down. The late 1990s saw increasing brand dominance alongside organized anti-corporate activism. Culture jamming emerged as resistance parodying ads and altering billboards to subvert their messages. Artist Jorge Rodriguez de Herrada transformed billboards in daylight, positioning his work as legitimate democratic discourse rather than fringe activism. Reclaim the Streets created spontaneous street takeovers, converting thoroughfares into surrealist playgrounds using sound systems and theatrical blockades. Their hybrid format, part rally, part festival, part direct action inspired, inspired thousands globally. The Global Street Party of May 1998 demonstrated RTS's reach with 30 events across 20 countries. Strong response to simple email notices revealed the potential for international resistance against public space privatization. At anti-corporate activism's core is the recognition that corporations have become the most powerful political forces of our time. With multinationals comprising 51 of the top 100 economies and budgets exceeding many nations' GDPs, they effectively function as our era's ruling bodies. What began as disconnected protectionist movements evolved into something more sophisticated, embracing globalization while seeking to reclaim it from corporate control.